From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the Palestinian bid for statehood, talk about default in Greece, and free enterprise in Cuba. The attempt by the Palestinians to achieve statehood has created mixed feelings in the West Bank and Israel. Far away from the speeches and posturing in Washington and New York, ordinary Palestinians and Israelis have their own thoughts about the idea. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro sent this report from Jerusalem.
Every day after the afternoon prayers in the Palestinian village of Michmas, the young with their baseball caps and jeans, and the old with their white headdresses and pressed shirts, sit on plastic chairs on this shady street surrounded by stone buildings. They drink coffee or tea, and they talk. But there's only one subject these days, and that is the Palestinian bid at the UN for statehood.
Everywhere, they talk about this. They want this to happen.
That's 29-year-old Palestinian Yunus. He's also an American citizen. He works in New Jersey, a sign of the hard times in the West Bank that have encouraged migration. He grew up in Michmas, though, and he's back for a visit. He says he's excited about what he terms the bold move Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is making.
This is something we deserve a long time ago.
His best friend here is Khalid, the village barber, also 29. He never left Michmas, though. And he says that while the villagers are excited, they are also cautious.
Yeah, there are lots of concerns about the futures, about the uncertainties, whether there'll be a state or there'll not be a state. If there'll be a state, what are we going to get out of it? If there'll be no state, what are going to be the repercussions? You know, there are deep concerns here.
But Khalid says life in the village has become unbearable. It's surrounded by Jewish settlements. There are five within a few miles of Michmas. The men have had to set up a neighborhood watch because the settlers make almost daily forays into the village to harass them. And so he says, whatever the outcome, he supports the bid.
The Palestinians are going to the unknown. But despite this, change is better. Even if we are going to an uncertainty, it's better than the status quo.
Nearby are the old men of the village. Some of them were alive when the State of Israel was created 63 years ago. They say they want to live to see a Palestinian state sanctioned at the UN as well. There's a lot of anger here at the United States, which has promised to veto the Palestinian move in the Security Council. Ribhi Hassan says there's an overwhelming feeling among Palestinians that the U.S. only does Israel's bidding.
American people is good people, always, but their policy is against us all the time. They are always with the Israeli 100%. They forgot we are real people, just like the American and just like everybody else in the world. And we're looking to live free.
The men around him nod. In Israel, the mood is far different. Young and old also mix at the Jewish market in West Jerusalem. At a cafe where men play backgammon and sip coffee, 77-year-old Ariat Daya says he's anxious about what comes after the statehood bid at the UN. Today I was on a bus, he says, and they found a suspicious package and we had to evacuate. It ended up being nothing, but I've been close to three suicide bombings in the past, he says, so I'm worried there could be more violence. But Daya says he wants the Palestinians to have a state with clear borders so that Israel will finally be left in peace. He remembers how it used to be before the 1967 war. There used to be a big sign, he says, border ahead of you, and you knew where things stood. Now, nothing is clear, he says. Akai Gov is a 30-something tour guide. He says he's fed up with the situation, too, as it stands now.
Maybe it's a one-sided action. Maybe it's not the best idea right now, but something has to give. There's no negotiation whatsoever. So maybe that will shake things up and move something.
He says the UN bid won't create a Palestinian state, But Israelis need to realize, he says, it will happen someday.
Eventually they're going to have a state, whether it's going to take 50 years, 100 years, or 10, it doesn't matter. Eventually they're going to have, because the ball started to roll, you know, the snowball started to roll, and nobody's going to stop it. One way or another, they're probably going to have a state. Where the state is going to be, what the borders, what's going to be the relationship between us and them, nobody knows. But I believe that eventually they're going to have a state, whether we like it or not.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Coming up, talk of default in Greece and bringing free enterprise back to Cuba. The week's global financial news was once again dominated by the debt crisis in Europe. The worst affected country, Greece, is still waiting to hear if it will get the next installment of its multi-billion dollar bailout from the IMF and the European Union. Without the money, Greece would default, with unpredictable consequences for the world economy. But the bailout comes with conditions that many Greeks resent. Some of them told NPR's Sylvia Pajoli in Athens that maybe default is not such a bad idea.
The taxi driver's car radio is tuned to a news program. The voice is that of Kostas Kordas. He's a former employee of the Greek Statistics Bureau who claims that European Union officials pressured Greece to revise and inflate its 2009 deficit figures in order to justify a desperate need for rescue loans. It's claims like these that feed a sense that Greece has been used as a scapegoat for the global financial crisis. Nikos Frangakis, president of the Center for European Studies and Research, says anger is mounting against Germans pointing their finger at Greeks, repeating old stereotypes, but ignoring the fact that their economic strength is also due to Greek consumers.
And therefore, they cannot easily swallow a German position that, it is your fault, Southern Europeans, that you are at default, therefore you should pay, and don't expect the German taxpayer to cover your debts, because the German taxpayer has benefited as well.
Many Greeks say the country has to fend for itself, and the D word, default, once a taboo, is being repeated more and more often. At an Athens University cafeteria, medical student Evangelia Angelina describes the devastating effect of austerity measures on the Greek educational system. No more books for high school students, and more than 1,000 schools have been closed. Angelina is the daughter of a plumber and a cleaning woman, and she fears the government will now impose hefty university tuition fees. She prefers default.
I think that it will be a good idea if it's our decision, I mean the Greek people's decision.
The government has already slashed public sector wages and pensions and raised the value-added tax a whopping 10% from 13 to 23. 100,000 small businesses shut down this year, and the EU is pressing Greece to lay off perhaps as many as 100,000 state employees and impose another 40% cut in civil servants' salaries. Greek default is now openly debated. One of the most quoted economists is New York University's Nouriel Roubini, who describes the bailout as a ripoff and urges Greece to default. Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis shares that view.
Greece must default. And the logic is very simple. When you have a huge debt built up and a debt overhang following a financial crisis, it is impossible to repay your debts, even if you are extremely willing to do so, simply by cutting through austerity. Austerity will make the debt crisis worse, always has done, always will do.
Varoufakis is outraged by the divisions among the EU partners and says their policies are just aimed at buying time. They refuse to acknowledge, he says, that the Greek crisis is just a symptom of a much bigger crisis within the European banking system.
Greece has not been bailed out. All the bailout money goes to the Greek state in order to repay the banks. Well, give it directly to the banks.
The contagion has started, says Varoufakis, affecting Italy, Spain, and France. He says this will ultimately force the EU to face the core issue, the lack of political and fiscal unity behind the euro, the common currency. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Athens.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The communist government in Cuba is loosening its grip on the country's economy. That's allowed thousands of small private businesses to spring up. It's a new frontier for budding capitalists, and competition is fierce. But advertising is still tightly restricted, and so entrepreneurs have to build their reputations in other ways, as Nick Myroff reports from Havana.
New snack bars and food stalls are all over Havana, but there aren't many that look like Tio Tito or Uncle Tito. The first thing you notice is the uniformed employees scrambling to serve up Hawaiian pizzas and fruit drinks as music videos play on a monitor behind the counter. The napkins and the to-go containers carry the Tio Tito company logo, and there's even a slick website, tio-tito.com, which is hosted abroad. That red and gold color scheme is no coincidence either, said proprietor and would-be Cuban fast food king Ivan Garcia. If those colors can work for McDonald's, he says, they might just work for him. Those are the colors that stimulate the appetite, Garcia said. I didn't make that up. It's what the research shows. Garcia's business is only one of two startup snack stands to make it in his Havana neighborhood. Six others have already gone under since last fall when President Raul Castro let more Cubans go into business for themselves. These days, it's no longer enough to hang a sign outside and sell sandwiches and coffee out the front door. Ismael Bello, another Havana entrepreneur, said the city's got too many vendors trying to sell the same things, so he's trying something different. With a new copy machine brought in from abroad, Bello and his family have started a printing and copy service called Havana, with an attractive, freshly painted storefront. He's competing directly with the Cuban government, setting prices at half what they are in state-owned copy shops. In 5 years, we could be a pretty big company, Bello said. Next month, we'll have our own website, and if we keep adding products and services, we can grow, he said. It's not clear how big Cuban authorities will let these new businesses get as they try to build their brands and open new locations. The government's political messages and propaganda must now compete with more and more commercial signage. But advertising is still essentially banned. So Cubans like Janet Alvarez have found other ways to stand out. Her baseball-themed snack bar, The Perfect Play, is quickly becoming famous among fans of Havana's beloved team, the Industriales, attracting crowds to her converted garage. Everything on the menu is named for something in the game, including a few rather unappetizing-sounding dishes like the dead ball and the squeeze play. But after toiling for years in drab, state-run restaurants, Alvarez said it's exhilarating to be making her own business decisions. She even used the F-word to describe it.
If a customer orders a sandwich, you have the freedom to say, sure, I'll make it however you want it.
That kind of choice is something of a novel concept in a country where nearly everyone still gets an identical government food ration. And the have-it-your-way ethos isn't the only formula being copied here. One new Havana establishment is calling itself Burger Ray, with Ray meaning king in Spanish. For now, with a U.S. embargo still firmly in place and no Whoppers to compete with, the market is wide open. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
For more international coverage, listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list on our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.